do an Amana. Yours, all right. Okay. This is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry. I'm speaking with Dr. Bruno H. Zinn at the Anaheim Hilton on the 9th of September, 1986. Dr. Zinn, you were born on the 31st of October, 1920, in Woodstock, New York. Could you tell me something about your father and mother, names, occupations?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. First, let me talk about the Woodstock. That's where we lived. I was actually born in a hospital in Kingstown, Kingston.
Oh, okay.
So that... my birth certificate says Kingston.
I see.
That was 10 miles away. But we lived in Woodstock. Woodstock has gotten some notoriety since as an artist colony, which it was at that time, but not so well known. My father was a sculptor. My mother was a writer, novelist.
And their names?
My father's name was Bruno Lewis, L-O-U-I-S. L-O-U-I-S. Sam, and my mother's name, maiden name, was Louise Seymour, S-E-Y-M-O-U-R, Hasbrook, H-A-S-B-R-O-U-C-K.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I was the only child.
I see. What was it like growing up in Woodstock as a young boy?
Well, it was... As a young boy, of course, I wasn't in a position to appreciate much of the culture that was going on. And the main thing I remember from as a young boy is that I grew up more or less in the woods.
Mm.
It was my father had bought an abandoned farm some 8 years or something before I was born. And he found that a good place to carry on his sculpture. And it was 2 miles out of the town of Woodstock itself, actually. On the side of a mountain, very nice rural environment. And then I went to a very local one-room school with an average of about 15 pupils in all grades until I went to high school.
Because of the activities of your mother and father, did you have any visitors that you remember to your home?
Yeah, they came time to time, not a great many. There were, of course, a number of artists and writers and musicians in Woodstock, and we knew a lot of them socially.
I understand you played the clarinet, is that correct?
That didn't date from that, though, however. I picked that up after I went away to boarding school, and my roommate started playing the clarinet, and I thought this looked like fun, so I picked it up, too, at the same time.
Were there any teachers in your grade school days, or anyone else in the community that had any influence on you?
Well, of course, there was one teacher in this one-room school all the time I was there, except for the first year, I think there was another teacher. The whole time I was there, it was just one teacher, a woman. She ran the whole place very efficiently and was a nice, sympathetic person. And I can't say that she influenced me specifically in any particular way, but she certainly didn't make any problems either. The nice thing about being in a one-room school is you hear everything that goes on. So when I was in the lower grades, I heard what the upper grades were doing, and that's, I think, helped me get through a lot faster than might in a more structured environment.
If I might stop for a moment, I think I'm having a problem with your what develops.
I could perhaps move closer.
Oh, now that's okay. Yeah. Now you're working all right. Want to try something?
Okay. How's
that's,
that?
That's good. Yeah.
Must have been a bad contact.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Okay.
Did you have any interest in science?
That developed quite early. Actually, I should say my father, though a professional sculptor, was actually an amateur scientist. Natural scientist. He was interested in botany and in geology, and he frequently went collecting fossils from the local rocks, and I would go with him on these trips. But before that even, I was really very much interested in mechanical things. Living on an abandoned farm like that, there were a lot of things that went on all the time of a mechanical nature, like the water system was always breaking down and it needed needed plumbing, and then we were too far away to be on the electric line initially, and we had our own generating plant, which also needed quite a lot of attention. My father wired the house for electricity when I was about 8 years old, and I was very much interested in that. So I sort of developed an interest in engineering things. And then my uncles, my father's brothers, gave me a chemistry set when I was 8 years old, and that really determined me to be a chemist.
I see. Did you do any experiments that weren't in the manual?
Oh, I certainly did. And when I went to high school, there was another fellow in the same class, Walter Lacusta, who has since become a chemical engineer, L-A-K-U-S-T-A. And he and I used to plan and do a lot of little experiments outside of school.
And did your parents encourage you in this?
They certainly didn't discourage me any. Mm-hmm. So.
You went to high school then in... I have here Socrates, was that?
Yes, I went 2 years to Socrates High School in 1932, I think, 34. That was about 10 miles away, and I had to take a bus so that there was no chance for any after-school activities. And my parents got worried about this and decided to send me to boarding school.
I see.
So they sent me to Kent School in Connecticut.
And I'm not
after that.
Familiar where in Connecticut is that?
That's in Kent, Connecticut, which is near Danbury.
Okay.
On the Housatonic River.
Okay. So you had... what was the high school like in Socrates? Did you take any chemistry there?
Yeah, I took general science. I was there 2 years, and second year, I think, I took general science, which was well taught. It was for a country high school, it was quite a good school. Socrates is a town that has some old money in it, and the town was rather better run than you might expect.
And then you took your chemistry at Kent.
Right, I took...
chemistry and physics there?
Chemistry and physics, right, at Kent.
Do you remember the names of any of the teachers? Did they...
There was... the chemistry was a priest, actually, named Father Wood. Or Woods, I guess it was. W-O-O-D-S, Woods. Father Woods. But actually, I didn't see a great deal of chemistry because I got sick in the middle of the year and had to drop out of school for... half of the year, so that chemistry I got was only half of the course. But by that time, I knew it all anyway.
Okay, so you already determined that was going to be your area.
Yeah, and I had been reading books. And
what kind of things were you reading?
We had a big textbook about 3 inches thick called, I think, Pharmaceutical Chemistry, which was lying around the house. I believe it was there because my father had been married before to a woman who was a chemist. And I believe this was something she left behind.
Did you have anyone that you could talk to if you're reading something of that nature?
Not really, no. No, this was... there were no other chemists around.
Okay.
No. So I just read the book.
And what about math? Certainly your work was highly mathematical.
Yeah, well, math was the usual high school mathematics. And I did a little bit on my own, I remember, at Kent, going a little beyond the courses occasionally. Something looked really interesting. But mostly I found high school mathematics pretty much a bore.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of drill and not very much inspiration.
That's interesting in the sense that when you did get into chemistry, you were a physical chemist where mathematics played a
That's right.
very important
I
part.
Think if I had really known what I've known since, I would not have gone into chemistry. I would have gone into physics. But the high school physics was also a bore.
Mm.
Not that there was anything wrong with the teacher. He was a good teacher, a man named Anders at Kent. But the course was the usual high school course of the time. I had a lot of mechanics. It got a little more interesting when we got into electricity and magnetism. But most of it was very elementary, didn't use hardly any mathematics, and it was really not very exciting.
Did you have any friends at that time during your high school days? Anybody that you...
Well, there's this fellow, Lacusta, I mentioned at Socrates, so we used to do chemistry together. And I had a great many friends, but none of them were particularly scientific.
I see. What kind of laboratory facilities did the school have?
Well, it had the usual high school-type laboratory. I don't remember that any chemistry laboratory. I think the laboratory must have been in the second half of the term when I was sick and out of school. In physics, we had an experimental session about once a week where we used some of the apparatus which was bought from standard supply houses and inclined planes and pulleys and some electricity and magnetism. But actually, I think the teacher sort of demonstrated things more than that. We actually did anything. So I think, looking back on it, I would say there wasn't much laboratory exercise in that physics course. It was mainly demonstrations.
Outside of the mechanical experience you had back at home, the actual laboratory experience...
Very little.
Very little, except again what you were doing.
Except what I was doing on my own, at home. Walter Lacus and I used to boil up things and mix acids and bases and pour acid on metal and make the hydrogen and light it and electrolyze things and all that sort of stuff.
Did you do that in the home or did you have it other places?
No, I did it at home. My father finally set up a wooden board workbench so I wouldn't mess up other things.
You said that you had developed your interest in chemistry quite early. What kind of career plans did you develop?
I thought I wanted to be a chemist. I decided I wanted to be a chemist, so I...
Did you have anyone you could talk to develop that?
Not that I remember. Except for my teachers in the school. Really wasn't much... one does at that age to develop a career. You go to college after high school, and in college, of course, you have to major in something. At that point, I already determined I was going to major in chemistry. So that was the only choice I really had to make.
The college experience, did your father and mother, were they college graduates, and did you have that background?
My mother had gone to Wellesley 2 years before she dropped out, and my father had gone to art school, but not to college.
Okay. And how did you decide on Columbia?
Oh, that was through the headmaster of the Kent School. He was a Columbia graduate, and he thought he could get me a good scholarship. Actually, he did help. It wasn't quite as good a scholarship as he thought, but anyway, that's how I went to Columbia.
That was, 1938, I believe?
Yeah.
Another question I had meant to ask you earlier was the effect the Depression may have had.
Well, very decided. We were very conscious of money problems all the way through. My father had one large commission that he got in about 1930, or maybe slightly before that, when things were good, and that lasted for about 4 years. It was carving a number of stone reliefs for a church in Philadelphia. And then after that, it was just sort of one little thing after another little thing, and we were very short of money. So I wouldn't say we were poor in the sense that we were a little impoverished, but had to watch money very carefully. I only succeeded in going to Kent School and also to college by the help of scholarships and from help from my mother's family.
I see. What was Columbia like when you arrived there in 1938?
Well, it was, I think, probably much the same as it is today. From my own point of view, it was a bit of a bore in that... curriculum was very structured, which I think was fine. I was glad to do it and get it over with, but it inhibited any creativity so that I didn't have anything very interesting to do in college. In order to raise a little money, I tried making and selling miscellaneous small artworks with the help of my father.
What kind of artworks were they sculpting?
Well, yeah, sculpture. We made ashtrays, for example. I put a Columbia lion motif on an ashtray with a Columbia engraved around the edge, and we made these out of pewter, and I did actually sell a few for, I think, a total sum of about $1.50 a piece. Sold them through the college bookstore and some directly.
Do you recall how much the scholarship was that you had?
$300 a year, and the total expenses for a year were about $900.
So did you do any, well, you supported a little, you had a little income from this activity?
Right, and I occasionally did some tutoring.
I see.
But I didn't have any regular job, like a, you know, job in a cafeteria or anything like that.
Of course, the chemistry department had a real lineup in that, in those days, in terms of the people. Who did you, in terms of faculty in chemistry, who was your first teacher?
In freshman chemistry, it was Ray Crist, C-R-I-S-T. He was a photochemist. And then analytical chemistry, there was a man named Zanetti, Z-A-N-E-T-T-I, taught qualitative analysis. Want me to go through the list while we're at it now?
Sure.
Then Beans, H.T. Beans, was quantitative analysis. Nelson, we all called him Pop Nelson. There's organic chemistry. And the laboratory was run by Charlie Dawson, D-A-W-S-O-N. Which was actually the first place I really encountered any of the faculty to talk to in that organic laboratory. Previously, everything had been such large scale, large classes. Well, except for the freshman chemistry, which was a small class, but that was just a lecture class, and you know, the professor came in, lectured, and went out. Then there's physical chemistry, a man whom I got to know quite well, Jake Beaver. And, yeah, I had an organic analysis course from Dawson also. And that was essentially it.
I assume from what you said, there wasn't even a laboratory with general chemistry the first year?
Yeah, there was. There was a one afternoon a week laboratory, which was not very interesting. It was not the experiments might not have been interesting, but there was such a rush. We had to go in there, rush through the experiment, write up the notes, and get out. And there wasn't really any time to enjoy yourself investigating anything.
Who was it you started talking to first in terms of the faculty? Was it Nelson? Dawson?
Dawson, I would say, yeah. Dawson. And then Beaver. Beaver ran a very personal approach type physical chemistry lab, so that he was somebody that one could really talk to.
Mm-hmm. And what did you discuss with him? Did you talk about?
Oh, mainly about, well, about the experiments we were doing principally.
And that this would have been the extent of the chemistry requirements for a BS degree?
Yeah, that's right. Those are the chemistry requirements. Normally one would take more. What happened was I got through in 3 years in one summer session and rather unexpectedly got through. So I continued right on in graduate school there. I didn't even apply to graduate school until the summer, the last summer session. And this was unexpected, as I say, because the way Columbia worked in those days, you got extra credit if you got an A in a course. And by getting enough A's, I accumulated enough extra credits so I didn't have to take a full senior year. But I didn't know that was going to happen until very near the end. So I didn't have any time to explore around for graduate school. So, and also the war was just starting, or just about ready to start at that point. This was 1941. So I was in a hurry. Graft was already in operation. I was in a hurry. So I went directly on to graduate school. Didn't have any senior year, essentially. Otherwise, I would have presumably taken more courses.
And you didn't do any kind of research at the undergraduate level?
No, no. Well, Columbia actually didn't have any such program at the time anyway, even if I had stayed another year.
And did you have any, take any math courses?
Yeah, I took...
Is that a better experience than what you had in high school?
Well, it's hard to say. I took analytic geometry and calculus first term, which was at differential calculus, and then because of interference of courses in the chemistry program, I couldn't take the integral calculus. So the following summer, I studied up on my own and took a test to pass the requirement for the course, which Columbia did allow you to do. And then I took the last term of calculus at the same time I was taking physical chemistry. So really, I only had elementary courses, and the one thing I did is study up on my own. It was an interesting experience, the first time I ever done something like that. Probably I got more out of that than taking a course.
And did you have any physics at this time, too?
1 year physics course, yeah, and that was a big lecture course with a one-session-a-week laboratory. It was a good course. I found it rather interesting, though it was pretty much the cut-and-dry type of thing. I think the most interesting part was electricity and magnetism, which was... But again, it was a course without much mathematics, so that it was a bit dull from that point of view. The fellow I had in the laboratory, ran the laboratory, was at that point a young instructor named Polycarp Cush, who subsequently got a Nobel Prize. He ran a good laboratory, really kept you on your toes. Though it was very elementary material.
Did you have any interaction with him on a personal basis?
Nothing very significant. I mean, I talked to him, of course, but nothing that would leave, you would call significant in any big way.
That you said then you, that summer session was the summer of 41, so it was at the end of that summer that the war heating up. You
I applied to graduate school right at Columbia, and they immediately put me to work as a teaching assistant with Beaver in that same physical chemistry lab I just finished.
I see. And what happened once the war broke out?
War broke out that fall. Well, everything just kept on going for a while, but then gradually effects began to appear. A lot of people dropped out of teaching and went into the Manhattan Project. Harold Urey, for example, was teaching a course in atomic physics that I was taking that fall, and he started the course, but he gradually disappeared from the lectures, and other people came in to fill in.
He was chairman of the department then,
and he was chairman of the department also, yeah.
Did you, well, I read, I think it may be one of those review articles that either you or Walter Stockmeyer wrote, that after the war started, Urey indicated that the war would be won by applied science and that people shouldn't rush off to join.
Yeah, that was Stockmeyer who said that. Stockmeyer was already an instructor and at the time, and I was just a beginning graduate student, so I wasn't in on those meetings.
I see. Evidently, you weren't about to rush off and join anyways.
No.
Yeah.
I guess I registered for the draft that fall and was waiting for them to come around.
So that first year, I mean, we'll get into what you did in terms of the light scattering in a moment, but in that first year, you simply were an assistant, did some teaching, and took the standard introductory courses. Is that
That's right, yeah. And study for the qualifying exam at the end of the year.
What other courses besides Urey's course?
Oh, a thermodynamics course taught by V.K. LaMere. And a course in phase rule taught by same Jake Beaver that I was being a teaching assistant with. There's a course in physical organic chemistry, so-called, which was actually a course in macromolecules, so not under that title. That was,
that's interesting.
That was taught by Charlie Beckman, who was a starch chemist.
What was the orientation of that course? Was it mostly natural products?
It was physical, really physical chemistry of macromolecules insofar as was known at the time. He discussed random walks, I believe. He talked about spectroscopic methods, x-rays, well, I guess more specifically, x-ray and electron scattering. First time I was exposed to Fourier transforms, to amount of anything. What else did he cover? Oh, he talked about hydrodynamic methods, sedimentation, viscosity. At the time, it all seemed to me a very ad hoc subject, but I guess I absorbed some of it nonetheless. He had an interesting style of lecturing. Not very rigorous. When the minus sign came out in the wrong place, he just changed it to a plus sign, but he covered the material. Plus, I also had a course of quantum mechanics from George Kimball, who was at the time helping to write the book Iring, Waldron, and Kimball, but it was not yet out.
Did you use notes then?
We used notes. He gave a beautiful set of lectures, which was possible to take notes on accurately. It's not usually possible. At the end of the term, I ended up with a very good set of interesting notes, but that was really all. There was no homework, so there was no chance to practice anything that he preached. And it was essentially an exposure to a lot of beautiful stuff without any real understanding.
How did he examine you then, or test you on?
I suppose we had a written exam at the end of some kind. I don't remember now. It couldn't have been anything very demanding.
And this was all before you passed the qualifying exam?
The quantum mechanics was in the spring term. The qualifying exam was near the end of the spring term, so the two overlapped.
Any other texts that you may have used in that early graduate work?
Let's see now. I should have got another course in there somewhere. Maybe that's all the courses I took that first year. Because I was studying for the qualifying. I think that must have been just about it.
Did Urey use any text, Lemaire?
Yeah, Lemaire used Lewis and Randall.
Okay.
He had his own copy of Lewis and Randall, an interleaved edition, in which he had written his notes in between the other pages. So every once in a while he would surprise us by getting something apparently out of the book which was not in our copies. After a while we learned what was going on. He used books by Hertzberg on atomic spectrum and structure, yes, and molecular spectrum and structure.
Was that was he rigorous in the classroom, in his lectures?
It was rather descriptive material about atomic spectra and structure, so that I don't think rigor is quite the word that one would apply. But no, I think he was accurate. He, opposed to, say, Beckman's course, which was not always accurate in detail. I think Urey's was, I don't remember any time when we ever found that he was saying something that didn't agree with the book. And in Lemaire's course, that did occasionally happen too. Beckman didn't use a text. Kimball didn't use a text. Beaver used a text called Phase Rule by a man named Findlay, F-I-N-D-L-A-Y. I still have it, I think. It was just a catalog of interesting phase transitions of various kinds.
In these other courses, you mentioned that in the quantum mechanics, you never had a chance to practice any of what was being presented. Did the other courses give you that opportunity?
In the thermodynamics, we had a lot of homework. Lemaire did assign a lot of homework every week, and we had to come in and put problems on the board. He would assign one problem to a particular student to put on the board. So we had a lot of practice in thermodynamics, which I think was a good thing, because Lewis and Randall as a textbook was not a very deep textbook, but it did have a lot of practical examples in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a problem with magnetic media anyway, yeah.
I can't take these back to the airport either. How many other students were there in that graduate group?
They were just about all in each one of these initial classes, and so as I remember, it must have been about 20. That included biochemistry students also from PNF, that's the biochemistry group at the medical school, physicians and surgeons.
Okay.
PNS. So I think of the pure chemistry students, there's probably like something like 12.
The appearance, and I may be wrong here, the appearance is that the department was concentrated in the physical chemistry aspects rather than the organic, is that?
Well, there was a fairly strong organic group.
Hammett was there then, wasn't he?
Hammett was there, right. A man named Elderfield, who was a synthetic, I guess natural products guy, actually, I think was pretty well known. And Nelson had done some rather interesting work in the years before, I believe. He was pretty old by that time. But it's true, I guess probably the more outstanding people on the group were the physical chemists, Urey and Mayer, Mamayer, and I guess they were the ones who were probably best known.
I was curious that you migrated towards physical chemistry, even though I think you said earlier that it was the organic laboratory experience that gave you your first...
I found the organic laboratory very interesting. In fact, I found organic chemistry very interesting, and I remember being rather uncertain as to whether I should go toward organic or toward physical when I went to graduate school. I'm sure I made the right choice, but I don't remember exactly what influenced it. Probably just a lot of little things.
Mm-hmm. Now, we approach the summer of 1942. You've finished the first year, and are you ready? Were you at this point getting ready, after passing the qualifiers, to select a thesis advisor?
Right.
And how did you selected Mayer? How did that? How did you make that selection?
It was a matter of going around talking to people, other students, and seeing what they were doing and what seemed most interesting to us personally, us, I mean, the first year class. Mm-hmm. The people I had interacted with strongly, Beaver was doing practically no research. He didn't have any research students. Lamayer, whom actually I worked for in that summer on a war project on smokes, I found to be a difficult man personally. And he was volatile. You never knew what he was going to do next. And I think that influenced me to a considerable degree. And also, he didn't have much of a research project emphasis at that point because there's a war work had really started up. Whereas Mayer had some interesting things in several areas, good physical chemistry, as good that even I could recognize at the time as a beginning student. And I had met him personally. He was actually had come around to help with the physical chemistry laboratory. He had come to help Beaver at times, so I had met him. So, and he had a very good reputation among the students. So it was that. Beckman might have been a choice, but at that time I didn't know much about macromolecules except for the course I had had, and I didn't realize anything about the significance of them, so it never occurred to me probably to work for him.
And Urey wasn't available.
And Urey was, right. Urey was all tied up with war research. And in fact, my friend Paul Doty had come to Columbia to work with Urey, and Urey told him that it was just not going to be possible. So Doty and I both went to work for Mayer.
Doty was a year ahead?
No, he was the same class.
Oh, he was in the same class.
Yeah.
Okay.
We ended up sitting next to each other in Lamayer's thermodynamics because Lamayer arranged everybody alphabetically so he'd keep track of who was who, and I was the end of the alphabet. And Doty came in late, so he sat next to me.
I would like to talk about those first experiences with the war effort in the summer of 42. Before we go into that, you had selected Mayer before, or was it?
No, I think we selected him by the end of the summer.
Okay.
Actually,
you hadn't done it.
Yeah.
And the work you did with Lemaire during the summer, was that by choice or was that sort of expected as part of the... how did you get into that particular project, let me put it that way?
I don't remember whether he invited us in or whether we went looking. But it happened very naturally, whichever it was. I think probably every graduate student at the time was being invited to work on something during the summer.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me something about that work on light scattering smokes?
The project was to work on screening smokes, smoke screens, in other words. And I believe it had been initiated by the OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, at, if not the initiation, at least with early involvement of Irving Langmuir. And Lemaire was brought in very much at the beginning of it to set up some of the experimental work. So Billy and I got in on that quite early. And at that point, the interest was in looking at smokes of colored dyes to see whether one could get a smoke which you could would be opaque at visible wavelengths but would be transparent at some selected still visible wavelength. So we worked on that all summer. I remember building generators to make smokes of these dyes, heat them up, blowing air over them to get a vapor and condensing it.
Where did you do this?
It was in the Columbia Laboratories, actually.
Okay.
Chandler Laboratory,
okay.
Sixth floor was the, that was the place. Sixth floor Chandler Laboratories, Lemaire's Laboratories, which he had been using before for all his other work, but they just converted over to this.
Did you have any ventilation problems or
the place had good hoods, good chemical laboratories set up, so we didn't have any problem that way. I do remember we had a fire or two from oil bans, which we put out right away with portable extinguishers, which were out in the hall. And then we had to build some sort of a spectrophotometer, a very crude kind, using just auto taillight bulbs and colored filters to measure the transmission of these smokes. We had a long copper tube about 3-4 meters long, extending most of the length of the laboratory. Introduce the smoke at one end, pass a light beam through two glass windows, and see what kind of colors were produced.
What kind of results did you get from that?
Nothing very interesting. The we could get smokes with unusual scattering and transmission characteristics. We had, for example, a green smoke I remember made from a red dye. It looked green and it'd transmit red light fairly well and scatter the shorter wavelengths. But it had to be a very dilute smoke because the particle size had to be very small in order to get these effects. If we went to a large particle size, then light was all absorbed rather than being scattered and absorbed in these large particles, and then you lost the effect completely. It just looked like a pink smoke. It didn't scatter anything especially. In order to keep the very small particles, you had a very dilute smoke, which meant that it didn't have much screening power.
You said that Langer had been brought in. Did you meet him at all during that project?
No, I didn't meet him then. I don't know what he was doing at that point. He never came around to this anyway.
I see. Just as an aside, last November I interviewed Hoyt Hoddle at MIT, and he was telling me about a meeting he had in which Langmuir was sitting next to him, and he had been describing some of the laws of jets. He was an expert on combustion.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that when Langmuir heard that, he said, "That's just what I need for my smoke screens."
Uh-huh.
So I thought I'd pass that along. Since
yeah, well, I don't know what Langmuir was involved at the time. He wasn't, didn't come around to our project anyway. He had helped get it started, but...
Mm-hmm.
So that was that summer of 42.
Now, did you continue that on into the academic year, or did
No, at the end of the summer, we went back to school, so to speak. And I was a teaching assistant in the physical chemistry laboratory, and probably took one of these courses that I talked about there. Oh, I know, I took a course in the physics department in quantum mechanics all that year.
You remember who you took it with?
A guy named Keller, Joe Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R. I don't know what has ever become of him. He was a fairly young guy at the time. Oh, and there was a course I mentioned, I forgot to mention before, in mathematics, differential equations. That was that other course in the first year.
First year?
Yeah. That was in the physics department. It was taught by a guy named Webb.
At that point, in terms of your math, was that becoming satisfying for you when you got to that course?
Yeah, that was an interesting course. It was a bit of a rush. They loaded a lot of material into us in a short time. But I found it to be interesting material. I've used it a lot since, too.
And this may again been something that Stockmeyer wrote, but I'll ask you anyways. There was the Mayer and Kimball had this lunch club.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in that at all?
We the whole research group of both research groups, and usually Stockmeyer, who was an instructor, and would go out to lunch. I think every Monday, or maybe not every Monday, but pretty frequently.
How long did that? There's a number of people evidently you met during that time, and I want to ask you about them. How long did this kind of activity go on?
I think it kept on right through my graduate career at Columbia. After a while, Mayer got involved with the Aberdeen Proving Grounds and only came up to Columbia on Mondays. And the rest of the week he was down there. But we still had the Monday Lunch Club. And Maria Mayer got involved with the Manhattan Project, so she was around all the time. Kimball was there all the time.
Did you meet some of the people that showed up, Fermi and...
I don't remember Fermi ever coming. Teller came once in a while.
Any reaction about seeing Teller at that time?
Actually, several of us went and had an informal course from Teller in theoretical physics for a while, and it sort of petered out after a while because it was very informal. A very unorganized course. He would get up and discourse on whatever he felt like. It was kind of interesting, but not a very good learning experience.
Was his reputation such at that time that...
No, he didn't have a reputation at that time such as he has since. No father of hydrogen bomb or anything. He was best known for probably the BET equation.
Right. Did you... You said you went to him. Did you ask him to do this then, or was he...
I don't remember how it got started. Whether somebody asked him, whether he offered, or whether some of the faculty suggested it, or what. But there was anyway. It did take place for a while. I think something like a couple of months, and then sort of died out.
Anyone else that showed up during that time, during that war effort, Kirkwood?
Kirkwood was not around. Fermi by that time was in Chicago, I think. The various well-known people, the big names, there were, I don't think there was anybody else, nobody I remember. They were all elsewhere.
And Urey was still gone, too.
Urey was running the Columbia Manhattan Project. He was the head of it. So he was very much around, but he didn't involve himself in any seminars or anything like that.
And were you aware of the Manhattan Project, or that work that was going on?
Yeah, but I didn't know what it was. It gradually one began to put things together, like there were jars of uranium nitrate stacked outside Pupine Physics Laboratories. And I was, during spring vacation, I guess of the first year, they needed some help in a hurry, and they recruited several of us to try a fractionation scheme on uranium, water ether two-phase separation business. Didn't tell us what it was for. I remember innocently asking, what are we trying to do, separate something? And there was sort of a laugh, and nobody said anything. I got the impression that was not the right question. But I think it gradually sort of percolated that it was an atomic energy project.
Was Mayer involved in that at all?
No. He was at the Aberdeen Peruvian Valley. I mean, he may have been involved in some way, I don't know, but he was not to any large extent involved.
How did his being away affect your PhD work?
Very little, actually. His laboratory was all there. There were some older graduate students who knew where things were. And if it hadn't been for the fact that I'd had a lot of mechanical experience back there on the abandoned farm, it probably would have been very difficult, but I knew how to put things together and solder things and so forth. So I didn't have any trouble. Mayer just suggested a project, and it was following work of some previous students of his, measuring vapor pressures of alkali halides. And in fact, there was even a starting apparatus that a previous student had started and then abandoned, so I could just get right to it. And I just talked to him when he was around about anything that happened to have come up, but usually it wasn't a matter of much necessity, it was just a matter of getting advice once in a while.
I've forgotten, was Doty working in a similar area?
Yeah, we both started there in the same laboratory at the same time. He worked on electron affinity of some halogen compounds, and I worked on vapor pressure of alkali halides, so it was very similar work, using much of the same apparatus, same galvanometers and so on.
Was this sufficient to keep you out of the draft at that point?
It was required. Well, I think more than that probably was being a teaching assistant.
Okay.
That was sufficient for a couple of years, and then I got my PhD just in time and got onto War Project again when the rules got tightened up.
So you really didn't get back to Lemaire's smoke work until after you finished your PhD?
That's right. 44, I guess it was. I got my PhD in that summer and started that spring, and I started work on his project at the beginning of the spring when my own laboratory work was finished, but before I'd written it all up.
Did you ask him to go back to work on that, or was that?
Yeah.
Let me ask a more general question. How were, in general, the effect of the war on the graduate students' PhD work? Were they able to combine any thesis work with war work, or was it separated?
There may have been cases in which they did. I don't know. In many cases, the man had to stop and go over to the Manhattan Project as an employee, essentially. That happened to several friends of mine. And in some cases, they stopped at the and went into the services. Actually, several of the ones that went into the project first were drafted, went into the service, then the Army sent them back. And they came back in uniform.
So they were fulfilling their military obligation by working on the project?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
How long did you continue that work with Lemaire then, until the war was over?
No, not quite. I was stayed there for until, I think, December of 44, and I knew about the project that Herman Mark was running at Brooklyn Polytechnic because Paul Doty had gone to that directly from his PhD at the end of 1943, and that seemed to me much more interesting work, so I managed after a while to transfer from one project to the other, which was by no trivial thing. You didn't change jobs during the war very easily.
I asked you how you managed that.
Yeah. Well, I had to get Lemaire's permission to leave the project. I had, of course, get an offer from the from Mark's project, and then I had to go and see somebody at the War Manpower Commission, I think it was called, in downtown New York, and get their permission to transfer. And I managed to do all that at the end of the end of 1944.
It raises another interesting question, that is that the transmittal of scientific information during that time, do you think it was highly curtailed? Were you having seminars?
Certain things were. We continued to have seminars at Columbia One probably thing worth mentioning was a seminar that Charlie Beckman ran on macromolecules, which, aside from his course, was really my first introduction to the subject. And I remember having to give a talk on rubber elasticity. So that was where I think began to see macromolecules as a possible research field as opposed to just something you learn about in a course. Well, that was run without any restriction. The restrictions, of course, came in talking about what was going on in the Manhattan Project. Nobody could do that.
Mm-hmm. And what had Jody been telling you about what Mark was doing? What was it that intrigued you about that?
We got into that. It was a bit of a sideline from the main project that Mark was running, which was working on polymers that were of use in films and coatings, things like this briefcase, mm-hmm. Which got military using for raincoats, gun covers, all kinds of stuff. But in the process, you need to know what the polymer molecular weight was. And this was something which I wrote up in that article you referred to in the Annual Reviews of mm-hmm. Physical Chemistry. Anyway, there was this new method that Debye developed to measure molecular weight by light scattering, unpublished, but Mark's project heard about it, so Doty heard about it, so he came back and told us about it because he and Macmillan, who was also a student of Mayer's, William Macmillan, and I were interested in light scattering because it looked like a good way to look at the critical phenomena that Mayer was interested in and which Macmillan was doing his thesis on. So when this light-scattering method molecular weights came up, well, of course, we were all attuned to understand what it was, and we had the apparatus, which Charlie Beckman had sitting around for years, and when he heard us talking about it, he said, I've got the apparatus. So we already used it to look at critical points in Macmillan's triethylamine water system, and all we had to do then was get some polymer solutions, which Doty could get from Mark's project and measure them.
So you did that at Columbia, though?
Did that at Columbia, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Doty was already at Brooklyn, mm-hmm. but he came back and forth, mm-hmm. and I was still at Columbia, just finishing up my thesis.
What was the offer from Mark's group for then? You just went through the mechanism for making that transfer.
Yeah. It was to join their project on polymer films. As I guess I call it a research assistant, I think was the title of the job.
And were you given an assignment then when you joined that group?
Look at polymer polyvinyl chloride degradation. They're using polyvinyl chloride mainly in the films, and it degrades easily in sunlight and also in heat, or both together. And my assignment was to study that.
And could you tell me something about what you found at Poly when you went there in 1944?
Well, it was a dilapidated old physical establishment. Columbia laboratories weren't so wonderful, but the Poly ones were considerably less so. And in fact, the lab that I had was the part of the old morgue of the hospital that building had been before. At least that's what they told me. But there was a very lively spirit among the people that Mark had brought in. He had brought in some young people, and then there were, of course, the older faculty members of the Institute who were happy to see us around, I think, and that was a good thing. They might not necessarily have been that way, but they were.
Mm-hmm. Which of those people that Mark had brought in did you interact with the most?
Well, Doty, a great deal. Alna Turner Alfrey, okay. The three of us had many interests in common, and we were talking to each other all the time.
And what about Mark? Did you get to see him?
Yeah, but he was, then as now, was traveling a lot. In case of Mark, it was a matter of his being at talks that we were giving and conversations in the corridor once in a while and so on, but not a matter of much of discussing day-to-day research.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about Turner Alfrey, your experiences with him?
He had gotten his degree with Mark a year or two before, and at that point, the time I'm talking about there, he was part-time on this project, and part-time he was working for the Monsanto Chemical Company in Connecticut. So he commuted back and forth for a while between the two. I'm not quite sure what kind of an arrangement that was. Then I think later in that project he came down to Brooklyn full-time. He was a thorough polymer chemist. That was what he had been brought up to, so to speak. And that was, of course, important from my point of view, because I hadn't had much contact with it aside from the seminar that I talked about up to that point. And so learned, I think, by osmosis quite a bit of polymer chemistry from him. He was a very easy guy to talk to and full of good humor and lots of original bright ideas.
Did you have any other, in addition to your interaction with the people and working on the project, did you do anything else at Poly in terms of getting more polymer background in your courses? Or
no, it was learning polymers there was a matter of learning by doing an osmosis from other people. There was just a lot of work going on. In addition to the people I mentioned, there was some organic work going on. A man named Hohenstein, Peter Hohenstein, had a group, I think also associated with the same project, several graduate students. They were synthesizing polymers. Forgotten just what.
Is Overberger there then?
Overberger was not there yet. No, that was later. There was Van Kooken, who was an X-ray man. And we occasionally used his equipment to take a picture of a stretched piece of polyvinyl chloride or something. And see, were there any other polymer people? I think not at that time. That was that's some students of Mark's and of Doty's. Oh, and then there's a biochemist named Kurt Stern. That's K-U-R-T. This is another Kurt Stern. With a C, but this is courtesy as a biochemist came there at that period, and his lab is set up right next to mine in the basement. He had an ultra centrifuge, and he was looking at DNA. My first acquaintance with DNA.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So
One of his graduate students was S.J. Singer, who is now a colleague of mine at La Jolla. I guess actually Singer was officially a graduate student of Marx, but he actually worked with Stern.
Now, you can you tell me something about the you were looking at the degradation. Can you tell me something about what kinds of experiments you did or what?
Yeah, never published any of it in the open literature. There was a big report written at the end of the project describing things that we found. But never any papers. We found a number of things which has since been verified by other people. There are also a number of things which were known to chemists working with polyvinyl chloride at the time, which I don't think had been much written down anywhere, but were just general lore. The effect of HCl, for example. If you stored a bag of polyvinyl chloride films in a warm place or in the sunlight, the bag itself was impermeable to gas. Maybe it was polyvinyl chloride. And you finally opened the bag, there was a big smell of hydrochloric acid came out. The PVC had split HCl out. That was well known empirically. So I did experiments with that. I'd put a piece of polyvinyl chloride film in sealed tubes, expose them to lighter heat for a while, open them, analyze them for HCl. There's a autocatalytic effect, presumably because of the low pH generated by the HCl there, would catalyze the splitting out of more HCl. So a plot a rate curve would take off. So I spent some time examining that effect and seeing what conditions were that would bring it on. Using very simple equipment, ultraviolet light sources, some sun lamps, and a big arc light source called, I think, a weatherometer, which they had there for a lot of other studies. Tried looking at the molecular weights of PVC as it degraded, but that didn't come up with anything very interesting, because we know now PVC is not completely soluble in ordinary solvents at room temperature, so that molecular weight measurements are really measuring aggregates and not individual molecules. But anyway, I was able to keep busy with lots of interesting experiments. Every once in a while, we'd have to give a report to a whole bunch of industrial people who were associated with projects. They'd all come in on Saturday morning, and we would get up and show slides of all these latest developments. And I think they were entertained and found some of it, perhaps, of some use back home.
What companies do you remember?
Union Carbide, DuPont. There were certainly two of them. U.S. Rubber. I don't remember what others, but there were a number of others, too.
And did you do any teaching, or were you strictly...
Yeah, I did a little bit of teaching. That was sort of after hours. Taught a physical chemistry course one term. I taught a course in atomic physics for chemical engineers one term.
Must have been an interesting experience.
Yeah. It was a good group, actually. One of them wrote me years later, saw my name in Chemical Engineering News in connection with something. And he said, at the time, they couldn't see what we're learning all this stuff about atoms for. And then that summer, immediately afterwards, an atomic bomb had exploded, and they suddenly understood.
This continued up through the end of the war, then?
Yeah, that continued through the end of the war. I stayed there until the end of the summer of 1946.
Once the war ended, had you given any thoughts to what you were going to do beyond that point?
Well, nothing very serious. I guess I was still very much involved with that project. Actually, through Joe Mayer, I think, who is a Berkeley PhD, I got offered a job at Berkeley. So, of course, I was very happy to accept that. Mm-hmm. Though I didn't really have to do much looking.
And you went there when? In the fall of
46.
46.
Yeah.
Let me back up for a moment. You have recounted rather thoroughly the work on light scattering that developed out of the Bies' early work, and what you and Mark and Doty published a quick paper on that. And you published a rather lengthy paper that followed.
We published first two letters to the editor, and then we followed that with a paper in General Chemical Physics getting more details. All this must have been 44 and 45, I think. And then we had a review article and something that Mark had started called a polymer bulletin, which has no relation to the current polymer bulletin.
I guess I'm not... I was trying to get at how this led you then into... Well, you didn't do any light scattering work once you went to Brooklyn.
Some. Doty actually had the main responsibility for that, but I helped with it. Some. We had one joint student there, got a master's degree, named Bill Affens, A-F-F-E-N-S, who worked on light scattering from polystyrene solutions. And we published that, too. That, I think, was in the Transactions of the Faraday Society.
But when you went to Berkeley, you picked up the light scattering rather quickly.
Yeah, well, I had been working on it, you see. Mm-hmm. Though the other things I was... My main effort at Brooklyn Poly was this polyvinyl chloride stuff. Light scattering was one of the techniques to which we used, which I think was not very useful for polyvinyl chloride, but I was at least familiar with the technique. I also developed an osmometer while I was at Brooklyn Poly for use on the PVC. That was with a student named Meyerson, M-Y-E-R-S-O-N. So when I went to Berkeley, it was just natural to continue that work.
The first thing you did was develop a new apparatus. Is that correct? That was, I think, one of your first...
Yeah, that was the first thing, was to build a photoelectric as opposed to a visual apparatus.
Could you tell me something about what led you into that?
We had been talking about a photoelectric apparatus at Brooklyn. And in fact, I think we had a photometer, which was... sold as a complete piece of apparatus, was called, I think, a photovolt. photometer. Photovolt, one word, made by, I guess, the Photovolt Corporation. But it wasn't sensitive enough. It used an ordinary phototube. What one needed for light scattering was a multiplier phototube, which had just become available. So I guess, I don't remember now for sure, I guess we talked about building such a thing at Brooklyn. And then when I went to Berkeley and found the electronic stock room and found people with electronics expertise, it seemed like a natural thing to do. Particularly when I got a couple of graduate students who needed projects to work on.
Did those graduate students start working for you right away, did they?
Not right away. I guess they showed up in the spring of 1947.
Okay.
And I was just starting to build the apparatus at that point.
How long did that take?
Building, getting the apparatus, getting it working? I had a very simple version of it going in a few months, but to build a good, reliable instrument took longer, and must have taken about a year. We published results on it in 48, and I went there in 46, and didn't start building until, I'm sure, until the spring of 47, so I think it must have taken about a year to get it really going.
You also collaborated with Stockmeyer, I think around, wasn't that long after you went to Berkeley?
Yeah, it was after I went to Berkeley. But, well, we had talked about collaborating on things when I was at Brooklyn. He had left Columbia by that time and gone to MIT, but he got back to New York once in a while, and I didn't. I went up to Boston once, and I guess we corresponded to something. Anyway, we talked about writing a joint paper using Mayer's statistical mechanical methods and macromolecule solutions, but actually we never got to doing it together, and I wrote it myself while I was at Brooklyn. But then we did succeed in collaborating on theory of branch polymers, and that was a paper I think we published in 49. We did that pretty much by long distance. I would write something and send it to him, and he would write stuff and send it back.
Your work is interesting in the sense that you're highly theoretical on one side, and yet quite practical in building a number of instruments along the way.
Well, I've always found that the two complement each other very well in a field like macromolecules, which at that time was rather undeveloped, and they needed both kinds of work. So if you could do both kinds of work, why is it's good to do that.
Which did you feel more comfortable in, or did you find more satisfying?
Oh, I found both of them, I think, equally so. I always liked doing things with my hands. On the other hand, I found I also liked mathematical physics, so.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can do both, why, one leads to the other. You do an experiment, then you need to interpret it, or you start developing a theory, and then you need experiments. It's very hard for a theoretician to persuade some experimentalist to do his work for him. Not usually so hard for an experimentalist to get a theoretician to help him out if he finds an interesting phenomenon, but it's fun to do it yourself if you can, so.
In 1950, you had a paper with Alvin Kalman.
Oh, yeah.
And was that, you mentioned DNA once before, but I'm looking when...
That was not DNA, of course,
no, but
that was a protein.
Right, but
yeah.
Was this, I'm looking for your introduction, your movement into the biological molecules.
Well, I've been exposures to it several places. I mentioned that Kurt Stern had his laboratory with his centrifuge working on DNA right next to mine in Brooklyn. And at Berkeley, I became acquainted socially with a fellow working on Kalman's project, a fellow named Walter Dandlicker, who was essentially a postdoc at the time. I think his wife was a schoolmate of the wife of one of the assistant professors in the department, Gwynn, who was a spectroscopist. And Gwynn and I shared teaching physical chemistry laboratory courses, and also they lived a few houses away from us in Berkeley. So we got to see a lot of them, Dannlicker, socially. And Dannlicker was working on this project for Kalman. I think that's how I got involved in it.
And what was your portion of that? It was physical properties of...
It was the light scattering.
Okay, you did the light
scattering. I did the light scattering. Yeah, they did the ultracentrifuge. They had the first SpinCo ultracentrifuge, the first, literally, instrument number one.
Mm. Where was that made?
That was made in SpinCo, which was where it is now, pretty much, over in Palo Alto. I remember driving over with Dannlicker's to see it when I was in the building stage. We drove over in a university car, a pre-war car, which his engine kept missing all the way over. We didn't know we were going to get there or not. That was probably in 47. So that was a protein. Well, anyway, I'd always been interested in biology, just as an intellectual interest. As a kid, I collected snakes, and I told you my father was interested in geology, and we collected fossils. I worked one summer when I was in high school. I worked one summer as a to help with a research project that a professor at Columbia Medical School, who lived in Woodstock, was running. He had gotten some money from a foundation to do this project. It was a psychology project. It had to do with asymmetry in the nervous system. And what it amounted to was to look for asymmetry in people's reactions to startling stimuli. So we had various psychology-type black box things, flashing lights and stuff, and noises, and we go around getting volunteers in the community to expose themselves to these things, and then we tell them we were doing various other things. What we're really looking for is to see whether they use their left eye or the right eye, whether they turn left or turn right. Anyway, so I was always kind of interested in biological things. I think I got paid 75 cents an hour for that project. Maybe it was 75 cents a day, I don't remember now.
Did you ever meet Calvin at that time? His name's on the paper.
Oh yeah. Well, even before getting to Berkeley, I met Calvin at American Chemical Society. I guess he was probably looking me over as a new faculty member. So, yeah. Everybody at Berkeley knew everybody else in the department.
I was going to ask you what Berkeley was like when you arrived there.
It was a very friendly place. G.N. Lewis had died just the year before, but his influence was still very strong around the place. That was a tremendous esprit de corps, and as I say, it was very friendly. There was no business of somebody being above somebody else or somebody standing on dignity. Everybody was always glad to talk about whatever you're interested in. So I very quickly got to know a lot of people, including Calvin.
What were the facilities like at that time?
As far as I was concerned, they weren't very much. A lab bench and usual electricity and gas and water, and I had to build things up, so I made several osmometers to start with, and I started building my light scattering apparatus and got some glassware from the stockroom to polymerize polymers in, and went out and bought a couple of fish tanks for thermostat bands, and that's the sort of thing. I remember having to put in my proposed research expenditures for 1 year at one point, and I put down $200 for the apparatus I thought I might need during that year, which consisted of things of this kind.
And you were there for 6 years. Did you get any external support then for your work?
At the very end, the ONR started up, and I got a grant from ONR, Office of Naval Research.
What about consulting? Did you do any consulting during that period?
Very little. I remember going to Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan once. May have been a couple other things, but they didn't amount to much, if so.
Would that have been on light scattering work as well?
Yeah.
Were they doing any of that?
They were,
of course,
yeah.
Alfrey was there by that time.
No, that was before Alfrey was there. This was when Boyer was, it was Boyer I actually went to see, Ray Boyer. And it was on light scattering. I remember they were doing light scattering. It wasn't working very well, and they wanted me to come in and see what I could see about it. My recollection is mainly that the solutions they were using were dirty.
Also during this time, we had mentioned this earlier, but you had in that article the derby hat theory that Mayer had, which around this time, you came back to it and did some more experiments. You and Doty, I think, had tried something much earlier, hadn't you?
At McMillan. That was the thing which we were doing when Doty heard about the Debye experiments. We were looking for the derby hat in McMillan's critical solutions of triethylamine and water. And we didn't find anything much that looked like it, so we didn't quite know what to make of that, and didn't do anything with it. And then the Debye stuff came along anyway. So when I got my apparatus working well at Berkeley, I think somebody organized a symposium on the critical point for the American Chemical Society, and I was invited to participate in it, so I set to work. I think the talk was to be at the end of the summer, and I set to work during the summer to make as many measurements as I could. And that was some of the early, I should say, rigorous, perhaps light scattering from critical solutions. But, I had really one of the first quantitatively accurate apparatuses.
Mm-hmm. And how did Mayer react to this?
He was very generous. It must have been an unpleasant thing, I think, for him to find that experiments didn't show any critical point, any Derby hat phenomenon. On the other hand, the experiments did show there wasn't a classical van der Waals critical point either. It was something more complicated, so I think he found that interesting, but I'm sure he must have been disappointed that Derby hat didn't appear. But he was very generous about it. There was no suggestion of his being bitter or anything. I suppose the fact that I was one of his students probably helped.
Mm-hmm. Around the same time, around 1950, I think, did you spend a year at Harvard?
Yeah, 50-51. I was a visiting lecturer there. Kistiakovsky had a sabbatical, and when somebody went sabbatical, they would bring in somebody to teach his classes for that year, so that was I that year.
I see. How did that arrangement come about? Had you been looking for something?
No, I hadn't been looking. I don't know how it came about. I guess I got a letter in the mail asking if I'd be interested in doing it. They were looking for somebody in a year or two previous, and they were interviewing people, and they interviewed Doty, and they interviewed me, among other people. Well, Doty actually got the job, and he went there. And I guess probably that was only a couple years before. They probably remembered that when it came to finding somebody to substitute for Kistiakovsky. So I guess they probably got either a letter or a phone call asking me if I'd be interested in doing it.
Did you do any research while you were there?
Yeah, I did some theoretical work on the critical point, actually, and also wrote up some of our other previous work.
Was there any other benefit that accrued from your spending that year at Harvard?
I, of course, made a lot of new friends, which is always a benefit. Kistiakovsky, E. Bright Wilson, various other people at Harvard, to a lesser degree. And, to get the chronology right here, actually, I'd gone to General Electric labs for a month during the previous summer for going to Harvard. And
I noticed there was an overlap in those dates.
Yeah, right. And that was a get acquainted month, essentially. Their interviewers had come out. I had actually interviewed for a job at GE about the time, just after I'd gone to Brooklyn, that not being a permanent job. So we were acquainted. At that point, I met Langmuir, actually. Made much more of a contact with Ray Fuas at GE. He actually, I think, was a consultant at Brooklyn. He came down there quite frequently. So I made a good acquaintance with him. Then the GE interviews came out to Berkeley in 1950. I was not entirely happy with the situation at Berkeley as it was developing. Looked like there was going to be more and more work and less and less play as time went on. So I talked to
him. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, yeah. Berkeley was very nice for a beginning instructor. They left you pretty much alone, do your research, and teach your course, whatever it was, and didn't have to do much of anything else. So the courses took some time, but not excessive, and you had a lot of time. Then as time went on, you got more and more into the workings of the department, and that meant you had more. There were more and more things to do. You got on committees. I remember I got on a committee planning a new building. And I could see where this was leading to. None of the older faculty at Berkeley hardly were involved with the research themselves directly. They all had their graduate students doing it. And that was not what I particularly wanted to do. So I was interested in exploring alternatives. And that's why I talked to the GE people. So they said, why don't you come around next summer and let's get acquainted. So I did, before going to Harvard. I think the Harvard thing developed about the same time. So I went to GE for a summer, for a month, and then went to Harvard for the year, and during the course of the year was offered the job at GE and took it and went back there following, instead of going back to Berkeley.
How did you react to the move from academia to industry? Had you done that purposely, or was it just that the GE people were there and you had been talking to them?
When I went and saw the GE atmosphere during that summer, and actually I had seen it once on the interview trip before,
it looked very interesting. It was a very, unrestricted tight atmosphere, and of course very good facilities. If you had an interesting project to work on, I mean, if you could find an interesting project to work on, usually they let you do it. So in that respect, it wasn't hardly any different from academia. But you could spend much more time on your research. And in place of having to teach a course and serve on committees, once in a while they'd come around to you with some particular problem they needed immediate work on, and that was the way you sort of paid your way. So at that time, when I was there, it was a very good place for doing that kind of research. For a while after that, it got much more applied. Now I think it's gotten back more toward the fundamental type of work. It was rather unusual industrial laboratory in that respect.
This was in Schenectady?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What kind of administrative arrangement did they have in the lab?
Oh, they had, I guess, much the usual kind of thing, starting at the top there as a vice president and director of research. And then they divided the lab into, I think, five departments, of which chemistry was one, and there was a director. And the chemistry department was divided into several sections, one of which was physical chemistry, and that was the one I was in. That had some 15, something like that, people in, with a manager who was busy all the time going to meetings, and the rest of us were down there at the bench, and we could put all our time in on the science.
You remember who the manager was?
Yeah, the physical chemistry manager was a fellow named Herman Liebhafsky. Lieb, L-I-E-B-H-A-F-S-K-Y. He had been actually a Berkeley graduate of PhD some years before. The chemistry manager was Abraham Lincoln Marshall. That was Liebhafsky's superior, Abraham Lincoln Marshall. And the laboratory director was C. Guy Suits, C. Guy, G-U-Y, Suits, S-U-I-T-S, who was an applied physicist, had some 50 patents, I think, to his name. They were a good group of people. Marshall was somewhat hard to get along with personally. Some people found him very difficult. I never had any problems. But, some people found it hard to know what he was thinking, and I guess that it was hard to know what he was thinking, but most of his thinking seemed to be good thoughts that came out.
What about others in your group?
At GE? Mm-hmm. Well, I shared a laboratory with several people. All the time I was there, it was with Fraser P. Price. We all worked on polymers. And for a while, there were other people who came and went. When the first one was John Hoffman, who is now at Midland, director of the Midland Institute.
I met him about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, did you? Uh-huh. Well, he hasn't changed much.
Okay.
Julian Gibbs was there for a while. Julian became president of Amherst last. And then there was Ralph Kilb, whom I collaborated with on a paper, K-I-L-B. It's now in Santa Barbara. He's not working for GE anymore. He's working with some of nuclear chemistry outfit, I think.
Were you given any particular assignment when you first arrived there, or were you just free at that point?
They usually left you alone to develop your own project unless you wanted to go directly into some already going project. And in my case, they just left me alone to work in polymer physical chemistry. So I started out trying to see if I could devise new techniques for molecular size and shape,
light scattering by then was pretty well established, and there wasn't much obvious left to do with it. Of course, at that time we didn't have any lasers, so there's no laser light scattering to do. And so I started looking into various dynamic methods, which I got into because of something I'd done at Berkeley on the Kerr effect, electro-optical Lyrie fringes. That was at Berkeley with Chester T. Okonski, C.T. Okonski, O'Konski. He's still at Berkeley.
Were you?
That was an outgrowth of the light scattering, in a way.
Okay. Were you sensitive to practical applications while you were developing this? In terms of working for a company rather than being.
Yeah. Well. My feeling was that if I could get a good alternative method for molecular weight size and shape, which were all those very tedious methods, that it would be useful in the laboratory because there's a lot of polymer work going on there. Marshall had some 30 chemists, and he had most of them working on polymer things. But I didn't have, you might say, real immediate money-making practical ideas in mind. And in fact, I think that was one of the disappointments of my interaction with GE, is that nothing of that kind ever really did develop. I got one patent while I was there for a process of making polymers of uniform molecular weight, but it was not a commercially interesting process.
I noticed that during that period, which is, we're talking about 8 years, I guess, 52.
9 years, actually.
Yeah, okay, 50, going back to
51 through 60.
That you published at least 25 papers, maybe even more, which strikes me as being a rather large number for being at an industrial research lab.
Well, as I told you, it was a pure research environment, and only occasionally did we have to get involved with some project that wasn't leading to publishable results.
Was that unusual for the time, or was that common throughout other laboratories, industrial
that
laboratories?
Was unusual. GE and Bell have always been unusual in that way, and more recently IBM laboratories and maybe a few other places have been like that. But most industrial laboratories, that sort of thing is quite unusual. People do publishable, more or less fundamental work sort of on the side in other laboratories usually, whereas at GE you could make that your main effort and do other things on the side.
How many other, during that 8 year or 9 year period that you were there, was there much movement within the group, or was it pretty steady in terms of personnel?
There was considerable amount of turnover. As you noticed, I mentioned Price and I were always in the same group there, but the other people, there were three, Hoffman and then Gibbs and then Kilb. So there was a fair amount of turnover. And there was a fair amount of turnover in the rest of the physical chemistry group, too, as people switched around from one project to another, new people came in and so forth. Yeah, I think it was unusual for anybody to stay on one project for more than 3 or 4 years, so it did happen.
Did Hoffman go to NBS after he left GE?
Yeah. He left GE, went to NBS.
You published at least one, maybe more papers with him.
At least one. We published a paper on thermal diffusion together. I think we must have published one or two others. I'm not quite sure now just what. When Hoffman was there, he wasn't much interested in working on polymers. He was interested in smaller molecule dielectrics. After he left GE, then polymers took a hold of him. And he got into polymers, where he's very firmly established today. So at that time, our research interests didn't overlap very closely, even though we were in the same laboratory.
I'm not clear on the dates now, but
you started some work on DNA about the time that you left GE. I'm not sure if that started at GE or was after that.
It was just at the end. Just before leaving GE, I went to Yale for the spring semester as a visiting professor.
In the spring of 60?
Spring of 60. And at that point, I guess I wrote the first theoretical paper on DNA, and also met and collaborated with a fellow who was at Yale at the time named Bill William Ginoza, G-I-N-O-Z-A, who was doing experiments on DNA as transforming principle, that is, carrying genetic information from one organism to another. I helped him interpret the experiments he was doing on the inactivation of this transforming principle by heat. In other words, a simple physical phase transition.
What led you to leave GE then?
Well, it was a growing interest in biochemistry on my part. I began to feel that polymer chemistry was moving pretty slowly. Certainly things like light scattering that I'd done a long time before were well out.
Excuse me, I think I might have left some stuff under here.
How did you set about looking for something then?
Well, I had been acquainted with biochemistry before a little bit through contact with Stern at Brooklyn Polytechnic, with Calvin at Berkeley, and with Doty the year that I spent at Harvard. Doty was already working on DNA at that time. And then I got interested in helix coil transitions from the theoretical side, because I think I was invited to give a talk on it at Brooklyn Poly sometime in the late 50s, so I had to go to the literature and look up what there was, and found that there wasn't very much, and thought this was a subject that ought to be amenable to some fairly straightforward statistical mechanics. So I got into working on that, and that sort of rekindled my interest in the whole biopolymer field as opposed to the synthetic polymer one. And then I got invited to join a month-long workshop, they called it, at Colorado, which is run by NIH, in the spring, or at the summer of 1958. And that really brought me up to date on what was going on. So I determined to go into physical biochemistry, or polymer biochemistry, whatever you want to call it, from leaving synthetic polymer chemistry. So at that point, it seemed like it would be probably a good idea to leave GE, because while they didn't object to my doing this, there wasn't anything of that kind going on there, and it really didn't look like it would be a thing that would fit most comfortably into the laboratory. So I started to look around to see what opportunities there might be.
What were some of the places you were considering?
Well, it was Yale. I reestablished contact with Berkeley, and then on my way out to see people at Berkeley, I was invited to come out and give a talk, actually. I stopped off at Chicago, where Mayer was, and he said that he was seriously considering going to a new California campus at La Jolla. So I worked that into the schedule and flew down from Berkeley to see what it was all about. I also looked into Stanford, too. That was enough places to look at. Make up my mind.
He went there then in 1960s, I think.
Yeah, that's right. There was a fellow from Yale, David Bonner, who was going there too, from the biochemistry group at Yale. So that was one of the reasons I went to La Jolla.
What were the conditions at La Jolla when you arrived there?
Well, that was very interesting. It had been up to that point just an oceanographic station. Mm-hmm. They'd gotten a couple of new buildings. They'd gotten at that time called a School of Science and Engineering officially established, which didn't hardly physically exist yet. But at least they had gotten the paper formation of it. So they were recruiting chemists and physicists and biologists. So we came there and moved into a new oceanographic building, keeping the oceanographers out of it for a few years, and started the school up pretty much from scratch, except for the fact there was an oceanography graduate program already going there, so we had something to build on. But we had to set up a curricula completely and advertise around to get graduate students.
Did you find yourself back on committees again at this point?
Of course. Of course, yeah. I think by that time I had forgotten what it was like to be in a university.
Were you able to extricate yourself, or did that have you continued to be active?
No, it's pretty much impossible to extricate oneself completely, but after a few years I did succeed in toning it down. So.
Where were your sources of external support coming from?
First NSF and then NIH.
Any consulting?
Not to amount to anything. An occasional consulting trip, one or two times a year someplace, and where somebody would come into town and want to consult right there. Mm-hmm. Instrumentation usually is what it was. And then I went up to Beckman's operation in Fullerton once, and a guy came down from, this was Hewlett Packard actually, and several other places like that. Aerojet General, I remember. Once or twice. They're all individual consulting things, not any long lasting relationship.
Could you tell me something about your graduate students?
Well, the first graduate student we had in the department, and the first one I had at La Jolla, was Don Crothers, who is now a professor at Yale. C-R-O-T-H, you have a name there, I think?
Yeah.
And he was, I guess he came partly because of my connection with Yale. The previous year he had been an undergraduate at Yale, though not at that time. But Harpst, H-A-R-P-S-T, and Neville Kallenbach. They're both physical chemists, K-A-L-L-E-N-B-A-C-H. Harpst is now at Case Western Reserve, Kallenbach's at University of Pennsylvania. So they and Don Crothers were, and Rodney Harrington was also a postdoc. He's from the University of Washington, Seattle. He's now at University of Nevada in Reno. They were the initial group at La Jolla, and then other people came in from time gradually.
And as I see Harrington's name here, it's some polymer degradation work.
Yeah.
But you started building instruments again too, didn't you? Or another.
Yeah. Well, we needed instruments to do things. My old light scattering instrument was still at Berkeley in a storeroom, and I went up there with my station wagon in June, I think, of the first year, and with the help of a couple of people there, dug it out of the storeroom, loaded it in the car, and brought it back, what there was left of it anyway, which was most of it. And then we needed other things. You can't do experimental work, physical chemistry, without instruments. There was no very good way of measuring the viscosity of DNA solutions at that time.
DNA is a very difficult thing to measure viscosity because molecules are so big they just deform very easily in flow. So we were trying to think of a good way of doing it, and I was washing the dishes at home one night, and I had a drinking glass in the sink full of water, and another glass happened to be sitting inside a somewhat smaller glass, which had a glass which had a heavy, very heavy knob of glass on the bottom, so it was properly weighted. And I was just floating there and slowly turning around, and it occurred to me that the only thing that was opposing that turning was the viscosity of the liquid in between. So that was the genesis of a rotating cylinder viscometer, which we then succeeded in putting together in the laboratory. Brothers and I worked very well for DNA solutions. People still use it once in a while. So that was an instrument. What else do we do? At GE, I put quite a lot of time in on viscoelasticity. As I started to talk about that before, dynamic methods of measuring molecular size and shape. And I thought of the various possibilities, considering a number of them, I thought viscoelasticity was probably one of the most practical because it's a big effect to measure. So I actually built an instrument at GE to do this and developed some theory to understand what was going on. And after going to La Jolla, a couple of the later postdocs I had thought it would be interesting to follow this up with DNA. Actually, the guy who was most interested in doing that was Stanley Gill, who was taking a sabbatical there. Stan Gill is at Colorado. He had, how do you spell it? It's two L's,
Yeah.
He had done viscoelasticity experiments when he was working, I think, in the Army Research Laboratory somewhere, shortly after the war. So it occurred to him it would be interesting to do this on DNA. So when he came to La Jolla, in anticipation of his coming, I bought a flow by refringence instrument, which is very closely related to the phenomenon. And he and another younger postdoc named Doug Thompson from MIT succeeded in using it to measure dynamic flow by refringence with DNA solutions. And this suggested it would be good to measure dynamic viscoelasticity. So Thompson actually started to modify our viscometer to do it. Then he left, and a graduate student, Lynn Klotz, took it over, L-Y-N-N-K-L-O-T-Z. That's a male Lynn, not a female Lynn. Lynn Klotz took it over for his thesis and did a very good job of it, and we got a really working instrument out of it, which we were able to measure. DNA relaxation times, and finally, sort of a long culmination to the thing I started at GE 10 years before, 20 years before actually by that time, I succeeded in really using it as a technique for size and shape measurements on DNA. So that was a long haul.
Yeah, so that some of those papers were just published not too many years ago, right? Is that correct?
Klotz's thesis was published in 1971, I think. The work was followed up by another postdoc, Ruth Kavanoff, who succeeded in doing a more spectacular work measuring chromosome sizes. That's a K-A-V.
Okay.
Kavanoff, K-A-V-E-N-O-F-F.
Okay.
Succeeded in measuring the size of DNA from chromosomes of Drosophila fruit flies, which showed that one piece of DNA went with one chromosome, which up that time had been something geneticists sort of like to believe, but there was no demonstration of it.
Let me back up for a moment. There is one thing that you wrote that intrigued me. At the very end of the Annual Reviews of Physical Chemistry article,
You said the circumstances surrounding the first publications of the determination of the molecular weight of polymers are curious from a bibliographic
view. Well, as I say there, the war confused the whole publication situation. So most of the Devise work, for example, was in unpublished reports, and there was just one short paper in the Journal of Applied Physics, and I think a later paper considerably after the war was over. So there was verbal stuff. Devise came and gave a lecture at Brooklyn, for example, I remember, after I'd been there a few months, and we took the best notes we could from his lecture.
How was he as a lecturer?
Well, Devise was an excellent lecturer. He was one of the best I've ever heard. He was in a very high class, above 90% or more of lecturers. Beautifully organized, very fluent. The only problem was you thought you understood everything while he was talking. And after he got through and he went back and tried to repeat it to somebody else, he realized that Devise understood it, but you didn't.
I was also intrigued by the fact that in 1946 you said you received unexpected reprints of Raman's paper.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out what precipitated that?
Not directly. I can just guess that he saw or heard about our work, maybe from Herman Mark. I know he visited Mark one time. Maybe Mark saw him in India. And anyway, all of a sudden, reprint arrives in the mail. I think Doty got one also. Maybe Mark got one. I know there's more some other people besides myself. But anyway. Yes, that was that. It was way back there whenever Raman wrote that in the late 20s or something.
27, yes.
It could have been used at that time. It was all there.
But like Gibbs with thermodynamics, it was not in a publication that was...
Well, it was in the Indian Journal of Physics or something. I don't suppose hardly anybody saw it. The people who could have used it would have been Mark, for example. I guess he never saw it. Mark had a research group in Germany. He had several different research. He had it, he could have very well gotten somebody to work on this if they had seen the thing.
What changes have you seen in your career in polymers? What would you say are the most significant changes that you've observed?
Well, there have been a number of a great many new polymers, of course. There have been new polymerization methods. The Ziegler-Natta thing came on in the 50s. When I started out working with polymers, about the only way anybody ever polymerized anything was with radical polymerization. So there have been a great many developments on the synthetic side, and then there have been a lot of technical developments, gel permeation, chromatography, the use of NMR. But actually, there's been remarkably little that has changed. There's been a lot of additions to the things we used to do back in the 40s. But a lot of them are still done. People still use light scattering. They still use osmometers. They certainly still use viscosity technique.
You had mentioned to me earlier that you and Michael Schwartz were writing a book. Could you tell me something about what your project is?
Well, the project is to write a comprehensive chemistry and physics of polymers, a textbook. We're still developing the concept. We have to decide, for example, exactly what audience we're aiming for, what level, elementary students, more advanced students, or monograph. We've pretty well decided that it's at the advanced elementary level, graduate students and seniors. And that makes it a textbook rather than a monograph. The aim is to write a book which
will, we hope, be interesting, authoritative, and comprehensive enough to cover anything that one might want to put in the polymer course extending over a period of a year, but not go too much beyond that for reasons of expense, and we wouldn't want to intimidate students anyway. So that is the aim, and the three of us being sort of experts in different fields of polymers, we feel we can write what we hope is an authoritative text anyway. Since Florey's 1953 book, there really hasn't been anything of that kind. There have been some joint author texts in which the authors were authorities in their individual fields. The, by joint author, I mean really more symposium-type texts where there are five or six authors. Those, of course, have difficulties in coherence. And then there have been a number of texts written by one individual, which is not possible for one individual to be an expert on everything these days, and the books show it. So we feel there's a need.
Do you have such a course at UCS?
We have only a small course. Our academic year is divided into three quarters, and we have a one-quarter course in introductory polymers, which is given to graduate students and senior-level chemistry majors. So that would essentially represent one-third of this book.
Is that course required?
It's an elective. It's taken by something like a quarter of the chemistry majors and chemical engineering majors, and some graduate students. So we have registrations running from 15 to 40 in different years. It depends on whether it happens to conflict with another important course. We always have those problems.
What do you see happening in the future?
In the polymer field?
Mm-hmm. I know that's
difficult. Yeah, well, that's... I hesitate to predict. You know, the interesting things that will happen will be the unexpected things, and obviously those are not going to be ones that I'm going to guess now. There's certainly going to be more refinement. As we get better and better instrumentation, we will get more and more into understanding the details on the physical level of what polymers do. That's one thing that's certainly going to come. What the molecules are doing when the gross polymer sample is doing something, that's what a lot of people are working on. And then I suppose there will be new synthesis methods. There have been in past years, and there probably will be some more. So I certainly expect that there are going to be a lot of developments. Whether something really unexpected or new comes along, like, say, the Ziegler-Nodick analysis or Schwartz's living polymers, is something nobody knows.
I know you have another engagement this afternoon. Is there anything else that you want to add at this point?
I think we have covered things pretty well. I don't really know. What else we should go over?
Looking at my notes, but I think I've covered most of the things I have in mind. Well, I would like to thank you then very much
okay.
for taking time to spend the afternoon with us.
Right. Well,
thank you very much, Dr. Gay.
You're certainly welcome.